Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy. Today's training class was developed by the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy team. During today's class, we're going to introduce you to the document, the Technical and Regulatory Guidance, and we do hope that this becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides, and then quickly turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are scheduled to go for 2.25 hours today. We do record our training sessions and offer archives of past classes. During today's session, the trainers control the slides. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation. It's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. Throughout today's training, you're welcome to give us questions and feedback. In the lower right, we have our Q&A box. At the question and answer breaks, if you're on the phone line, you can also unmute your phone and ask questions out loud. And at the end of the class, we are looking for everyone to give us your feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. We're developing new classes next year, and your feedback is often something that we can use when we're working with trainers for future classes. The feedback form also gives you the opportunity to create a certificate of participation for yourself. So if that is something you would find useful, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended, and the system is going to generate that certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website, not only to see what other documents are available. We have our training schedule for next year available for the online classes. This is also a great opportunity for you to look to see what active teams are still going on and see how you can become more involved with ITRC. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All of our trainers were members of the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy team. That team was led by Najee Akhlatis of the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Alex McDonald is a senior engineer in the technical support section of the cleanup unit at the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board in California. He primarily works on cleanup of the Aerojet site in Rancho Cordova and other nearby sites such as McClellan Air Force Base. Ryan Wymore works for CDM Smith in Denver, Colorado. He specializes in innovative groundwater remediation technologies, particularly bioremediation, monitored natural attenuation, and chemical oxidation. Trevor King is a senior project manager and technology lead in Warrenton, Pennsylvania. His expertise includes project management, developing conceptual site models, and developing remedial objectives and site closure strategies. Dr. Dan Bryant is Vice President and Senior Project Manager for GeoCleanse International in New Jersey. He holds 3 patents related to biological and chemical in situ treatment technologies and is involved in design and implementation of in situ chemical oxidation projects in the U.S. and Europe. Aaron Cohen is a Project Contract Manager at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in Tallahassee. He supervises and coordinates the cleanup of chlorinated solvents and hazardous waste sites within the Florida Dry Cleaning Solvent Cleanup Program, the state-funded Hazardous Waste Program, and Superfund. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is Vice President at CDM Smith in Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development, demonstration, and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. On slide 6, I'll now turn the presentation over to Alex McDonald from the California Water Board. Alex?
Thanks, Juliana. During the development of previous ITRC documents on DNAPL, it became clear to our team that there are many DNAPL sites where there was no clear strategy in dealing with them. At a number of these sites, money was continuing to be spent over long periods of time without sufficient environmental benefits being seen. We determined that a process for developing a DNAPL site strategy was needed, and thus the production of our integrated DNAPL site strategy, which we believe can significantly improve the remedy process at these sites. Slide 7. We found that there are four main challenges with DNAPL sites. First, in order to efficiently clean up a site, sufficient knowledge of the site is needed. You need to know geology, hydrogeology, soil strength, location of the DNAPL, and other components of the contamination. Many times, there is not an adequate understanding of the site to allow appropriate remediation decisions to be made. Secondly, the DNAPL matrix is complex, leading to the contamination to be found in free, dissolved, and vapor phases. The complexity is compounded by these different phases being found in a variety of different geologic media. Third, some remedial objectives are established that are unrealistic in that they may not be able to be measured or achieved within a reasonable period of time. And lastly, if the remedy selected does not work, there's not a process in place to determine what to do next. Our team decided to come up with a solution to these issues. And who is that team? Now, as can be seen on this slide, our IDSF team is composed in similar fashion to other ITRC teams. There are representatives from a number of state environmental regulatory agencies, federal regulatory agencies such as the Department of Defense and Energy, academia, community stakeholders, and in the group with the most representatives, members of the environmental consulting and remediation companies. Most of these team members have been together for quite a long time now in developing several other ITRC documents on evaluation and remediation of sites with DNAPL. So what is our proposed solution? It is the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy, or IDSS. The IDSS is a comprehensive management approach to dealing with a site. It is a process, I'm going to express that, is a process by which a project team can develop a site-specific strategy. There's not one strategy that will fit every single site out there. The IDSS is ideally used as early in the site evaluation and remediation process as practical, and developing site-specific strategy added to as new information about the site is known. This IDSS is not for the remediation novice, but should be used by those with site evaluation and site cleanup experience, as DNAPL remediation is a complex issue. So slide 10. Here's basically the layout of our site, and this slide shows the flowchart establishing an integrated DNAPL site strategy, and also the roadmap that you'll see is throughout our document. This is also the order in which we present this training. As you can see, we first start with the development of a site conceptual model. Our most important first step, and without a good site conceptual model, developing a remedy that will work as wanted is difficult at best. Next, we proceed with establishing remedial objectives, here focusing on using SMART criteria in this process, and Trevor will get into that a little bit later, talking about what SMART criteria are. We can then choose a remedial approach to meet our objectives. And then, in order to determine how effective the remedy is, you need to do some monitoring. And based on that monitoring, the effectiveness of the remedy is determined. Lastly, the remedy is evaluated to determine if it is working, if alternate remedies are needed, and or if the conceptual site model needs to be updated. Slide 11. What are you going to learn from today's presentation? After the presentation and after reading the document, make sure you download that document from the ITRC website. Is how to develop a site-specific strategy for your site, how the development of SMART objectives provides a better way to measure site cleanup, how, where, and why to measure remediation performances and progress of achieving site cleanup objectives, how to couple and transition between remedy technologies, and lastly, if your remedial approach does not seem to be working, how to go about reevaluating and improving that remedy. Well, that completes my introduction, and now let's get on with the interesting stuff. We'll start off with Ryan Wymore of CDM Smith in development of the site conceptual model.
All right. Thank you, Alex. So we are on slide 12 of the presentation, and as Alex mentioned, and probably not surprising to any of you, where we're going to start is with the conceptual site model. The first part of the IDSS process we really want to emphasize as a team is to establish a robust, as complete as possible, conceptual site model that encompasses a lot of things. This is the first step in the process before you start looking at treatment technologies or before you start even considering what your remedial objectives might be. Those are topics that will come a little bit later. But first, everyone needs to be on the same page as to the conceptual site model for the site. In fact, our team has felt so strongly about the characterization of these sites that we have developed a separate guidance document and training specifically on characterization of DNAPL sites that we've got a link to a little bit later on in the slides. But we really wanted to just further expand the emphasis on development and maintenance of a CSM for a site, particularly a site that has been contaminated with DNAPL. So that goes into great detail and covers everything that I'm going to talk about here. What I'm going to go through in the next few slides is kind of a summary of that and the level at which we discuss it as a part of the IDSS process. So when we think of a conceptual site model, we of course want to start with the physical system itself. So what does the aquifer look like? What are the geology and hydrogeologic conditions? The distribution of contaminants. Of course, we want to incorporate fate and transport processes. And then also think about the source plume relationship, which is something that as we go through some of these slides, you'll see has changed. The thinking of that has changed over the past several years in terms of what really is a source at a DNAPL site. We're not going to go into great detail about risk evaluation or anything like that, but we're going to mention them just for the sake of completeness, because when you're building your CSM and you're thinking of all these aspects related to the physical system and the processes that are important, you obviously also want to consider whether and how and to what extent it's impacting people. So we do have a focus on receptors. And then, of course, we consider essentially all phases or all media that could be impacted by the contamination, the vadose zone, the saturated zone, potentially even surface water. So as you're starting off the process, moving to slide 13, whether you're using IDSS for a new site or probably more likely you're applying the process to an existing site, what's the status of your conceptual site model? If it really is something like this where it's kind of a black box, you know that there's a plume and there's a source or there was at some point and there's a receptor, then this is kind of a black box and you probably need to do some further development and refinement. And of course, this is an exaggeration here, but I think we've all seen sites that maybe don't have a whole lot more detail developed than this for the conceptual site model. So what we cover in the document, what I'll touch on here, several topics that are related to conceptual site models at DNAPL sites. Of course, there is the presence and impact of the DNAPLs themselves. We'll talk about geology, and as I mentioned, the source plume relationship, how diffusion can play into that, what the response to treatment could be, and that is directly related to the distribution of contaminants at the site. So moving to slide 15, the take-home message here, as you can kind of gather from the slide, is that it's complicated. There are a lot of things that are at work at a DNAPL site, and we need to consider all of them in building and developing the conceptual site model. So we've put several figures from the document itself here. We have an initial depiction, the general DNAPL release and transport. This is something that I think we've all seen with a release of some kind of a product that then evolves a dissolved plume. We can have some degradation reactions related to fate and transport. And there's sorption processes and all kinds of stuff like that. So the conceptual site model needs to consider all of that. There's a lot of different phases that are present at the site, and you need to understand where the contaminants are in terms of which phases the mass might be in. It could be in all of them. You could have DNAPL, vapor, sorbed, and aqueous. And there are processes that can result in transfer from each of those phases to other phases. So that all needs to be accounted for in the conceptual site model. Then there's the issue of the DNAPL itself, which we'll go into a little bit more on the next slide. But what does that look like at your site? So moving to slide 16, the DNAPL itself. Back maybe 15 years ago or so, when one was encountering or working on a DNAPL site, a lot of times the first thing that we would think about is, okay, we have to find where the DNAPL is. We've got to go look for it, you know, define the extent of it, where it's at, even in three dimensions, so that we can, you know, locate it and pump it out if we can. Of course, we now know that the sites where you can actually do that are probably fairly rare, and at least in the minority, where you've got large volume, you know, such a massive release of product that you have DNAPL that you can extract like that. So the principle at work here is, what is the saturation of DNAPL? So if we think about the pore space in an aquifer, obviously if it's not contaminated, that could be filled with either water or air. At a DNAPL site, it can also be occupied by DNAPL. So if there's enough DNAPL released, and this is, of course, site-specific, dependent on the geology and the materials present at the site, but it is possible for enough DNAPL to be released and to be present that it forms a separate phase that is interconnected through pore space that itself can migrate. So you can actually have mobile migrating DNAPL at a site that you need to understand and consider. So this might be what we would consider the DNAPL pool idea, or something at least where you go out to a well and there's several feet of DNAPL in it, and you nail the well or even pump it out and it fills back up. So that does and can happen, but probably more commonly is the DNAPL is present at a residual phase. So in this case, there is still DNAPL blobs in the pore space. It's just that they are, for the most part, isolated, and they're not interconnected, and therefore they're not capable of migrating. So they can still be a significant source for the plume or even to the vadose zone, but the DNAPL itself is not a separate phase that is going to move around and migrate at a site. So again, the document goes into a lot more detail in the new DNAPL site characterization document goes into even more detail about specific properties of DNAPLs, you know, characteristics of DNAPLs that are important and how they govern the transport and migration and such. But for purposes of our IDSS process, the important thing is really understanding whether it's residual or mobile. So moving to slide 17, overlaying on top of all this is the geology itself. So we understand some of the aspects and complexities associated with DNAPLs. Now imagine those complexities in an aquifer that itself is complex. So we've got some various depictions here of how we might conceptualize a site. The first one is at the top, pretty simplistic. An aquifer that's unconfined, one that's confined, separated by presumably some kind of a clay or silt. And then maybe there's some contamination in one or both of those aquifers. A little more complex is something that maybe we've gridded off the site and built a three-dimensional model that can be, you know, not a trivial effort, but still what we need to keep in mind is what we're really representing is reality, which is very complex. It seems like the more we learn about DNAPLs and DNAPL sites and about our specific sites is the more we appreciate how complex they can be. Just between small-scale variations in geology that now we are understanding can be important, and just the presence of the contaminants in the various phases, it certainly, at least to me, seems to be, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize that these systems are pretty complex. Now, that being said, it doesn't mean that nothing can be done and that you can't deal with it. That's the whole point of our IDSS process. But our point here is just to emphasize that you need to really try to get at this complexity issue and use tools and techniques that are available to help understand it. So let's talk a little bit about this issue of diffusion, and let's conceptualize what might happen at a DNAPL release site. So here on the top right, we have conceptualized an aquifer that's pretty simple, a sand underlain by a clay. And let's say there was a DNAPL release such that it has formed a pool in the sand, kind of sitting on top of the clay. It's moved down so that it's at that interface. And you think in early time, there's going to be, of course, dissolution of the DNAPL in the sand aquifer and advective transport down gradient, but you're also going to have diffusion start to happen into the lower permeability zone below it. We then move to late time, where, again, let's consider that this was a discrete DNAPL release. It wasn't continuous or it's not ongoing. There will come a time where the DNAPL is dissolved, and there may still be some kind of a residual source left, but the pool is gone. And now you have this back diffusion where the low permeability clay has a bunch of stored mass that is now going to diffuse back into the sand over time. And note that while that might be most prominent where the DNAPL pool was, it can also happen down gradient because the high dissolved phase concentration that would have been present just down gradient of the DNAPL, there's diffusion from that into the clay as well. So what you end up with in this late time is a more distributed source where it's not one discrete area that is only DNAPL. It's likely a bigger area, depending on the extent of this low permeability zone, that is now going to sustain the plume through back diffusion, potentially over long time frames. So here, again, let's overlay this concept onto a very simplified cross-section. In this case, let's say we've got one high permeability zone right here that has groundwater velocities much higher, like orders of magnitude higher than above or below it. Again, this is just a simple illustration here. And then we have low permeability lenses in a few spots, and then the rest of it's just kind of a medium permeability. So into this system, let's say there was a DNAPL released. In the early stage, shortly after the release, you still have a DNAPL phase, and that's shown by the red here. It's migrating downward, and maybe it hits a low permeability lens here, and that completely stops it, or maybe some of it gets through there. But the point is, immediately surrounding this, you have zones of high concentration. And then further down gradient, there are low concentrations, but it is starting to move down gradient because of advection and dissolving from the DNAPL. But in this zone down here, it's just going to take off. As soon as it hits this zone, groundwater flow is going to carry it much farther down gradient than either above or below it. So then after some time on slide 21, again, this is a discrete release, so there's no more DNAPL coming into the system. At some point, the DNAPL, at least as a mobile phase, is going to be gone. There may still be a residual source left, but you've kind of got an even or at least a uniform distribution of contaminants throughout most of these zones where we've depicted it as a moderate concentration. And again, this is an oversimplification, and we're speaking in a relative sense in terms of these concentrations. But in this case, you still haven't had a whole bunch of diffusion happen, but the DNAPL is pretty much gone. So then at a late stage, let's say this is years to decades later, the DNAPL is gone, and these low permeability zones essentially are fully charged with source mass. It's been diffusion that has gone far into these zones, and the concentrations in the pore water in those lithologies are really high, and by contrast, the permeable zone that has seen many, many pore volumes of water flush through it, maybe by now the concentrations are a lot lower, at least in a relative sense. So now we have the back diffusion situation where we've got the mass that is tied up in these zones that is now going to diffuse back out, even from this zone into the really permeable zone over time. And this gives us the tailing that we see at pump and treat sites, and this gives us the kind of sustained concentrations that we see at these sites that can just last for a really long time. So moving to slide 23, let's consider all of this in the context of treatment. So on the right here, we've got the three depictions of early, middle, and late stage. Let's think about what the response to treatment might be in each one of these cases. And the take-home message is that it really does depend, the prospective effectiveness of the treatment depends on which stage that your site is. And we're going to hear a lot more about this as we get into to treatment technologies here in a little bit. But let's just envision that you were considering an aggressive source remediation. You'd get the most bang for the buck if you were able to implement that in the early stage when there is still a separate phase DNAPL, and you certainly haven't developed these low permeability zones that have had a whole bunch of mass diffuse into them. So in that case, you may be able to implement a source remedy that is very effective and that has a really significant impact on conditions both in the source and down gradient. But then let's consider you're evaluating the same thing at a late stage site where mass has been in the system for decades and you've got these low permeability zones that have a bunch of mass in them that are going to diffuse out over time, and you're going to where you know the release was, so you're doing your source remediation here, you're obviously not going to get as much mass out, and in fact, the action that you take here might not have a big impact on, for example, down gradient, mass flux, or mass discharge, because you've got this back diffusion controlling the response to the plume. So another point here is that a lot of our in-situ treatment technologies preferentially treat the high permeability zones. So let's say that you are able to get to a site that's in the middle stage and you do some kind of a treatment on this zone that is the higher permeability zone. Again, while that zone itself may clean up very well, there can still be diffusion back into that zone, which would mean you have to account for that in some way with your treatment, that maybe you know you have to operate the treatment for longer to account for that. So taking that idea a little bit further in terms of this source and plume relationship here on slide 24, a few years back a group did basically a bunch of modeling simulations to look at, okay, on the x-axis here, we've got source mass reduction. So in the model, we simulate that you get out 40% or 60% or 80% or even 100% of the mass. What is the impact on the downgradient plume flux? So that's what this axis is. So, you know, I remember back 15 years ago or so, there was a lot of debate about this, that, you know, on one camp, people were saying, you know, you really need to go after the source because if you can get, you know, a bunch of the source mass out, then the rest of the plume will clean up, you know, in an instant, essentially. And then there were others who were saying, no, the complete opposite is true. You know, you can have a site where you can spend millions of dollars trying to remediate the source and it won't really make any difference down gradient. So, of course, the real answer is that it's somewhere between those, which is shown by these various curves. So the perfect one-to-one relationship would be right down the middle here. For example, if you remove 50% of the mass, you would get a 50% reduction. So essentially what controls this is how heterogeneous your site is. So sites that are very homogeneous, you actually have to remove more source mass to get a response down gradient. So the points that I just picked, you get a 60% reduction in source mass and you get something like a 40% plume response on this curve. At heterogeneous sites, the reverse is true. So let's say you're way up here on this curve and you get a 40% reduction in the source, you can have more than an 80% reduction down gradient in terms of plume flux. The reason, if you think back to what we just talked about, is the fact that maybe your source remedy is only cleaning up these high permeability zones. So therefore, if you have a really heterogeneous site where maybe there is something like what we just depicted with our simple cross-section, if you're able to clean up that one zone, even though you didn't get a lot of the mass out, you cleaned up the mass that was coming through the highest groundwater flow zone, so you do have a big impact. The other take-home from this is, if you are at a heterogeneous site, and let's say you really do need to get up into the 90% reduction or more, it takes a lot of mass removal to get from here on this curve to over here on this curve. So the take-home message is that this plume and source relationship depends on how heterogeneous the site is, and it's not necessarily simple and straightforward, but to really try to get to the end game, I guess you would say, at heterogeneous sites can be really difficult, again, because you've got back diffusion controlled systems. All right, so the last topic that we talk about in the IDSS that we introduce here is the 14-compartment model. This is something that was developed by Tom Sale and Chuck Newell several years ago. I'm sure a lot of you have probably seen it, but the idea is it's a framework to conceptualize where the mass is stored at your site and to consider interfaces and mass transfer between these phases. So the 14-compartment model itself is just this matrix down here. You can see the different phases, vapor, denapple, aqueous, and sorbed. And then we have the source zone and the plume. And within each one of those, we're grouping together low permeability in one compartment and transmissive in another. So obviously, this is an oversimplification. But the concept is you've got zones that are, for whatever site you're working at, more transmissive, and then the lower permeability zones. And of course, the reason it's 14 compartment and not 16 is because denapple in the plume is not applicable. So that's how we get to the 14 compartments. So we want to emphasize this is not quantitative. So you're not, just because you've checked one of these boxes, there could be a whole bunch of mass in this box and not very much in this box. And as we'll see here in a minute, this is going to depend on the stage of your site. But this is a concept of it, and then these arrows can represent transfer between the different phases. So again, even though it's kind of a simplistic framework to conceptualize your site, it can still get pretty complicated when you think about all the interfaces. So bringing this back to our simplified site, we've got our early, middle, and late stage sites. Let's apply the 14-compartment model to each one of these. In the early stage, because not very much time has elapsed, the mass is in the transmissive zone, essentially just in the source. So obviously the mass, in a relative sense, in the denapple zone is high because the denapple still exists as a mobile phase. And then you've got moderate concentrations, maybe in aqueous and sorbed, and maybe even in vapor, because maybe this has gone down through the vado zone, and you've got quite a bit of mass in the vapor phase. And then down gradient in the plume, it's really only showing up in the aqueous phase, maybe one of those high concentration zones like we depict over here. In the middle stage, everything is kind of evened out, so to speak. And then in the late stage, you get to this point where the denapple mass is low, maybe it's just a little bit of residual left, and essentially the transmissive zones, the mass has attenuated or at least gotten down to a lower level, just maybe because of treatment or maybe because of just flushing, many pore volumes going through. But then at this late stage, you can have moderate amounts of mass, at least in a relative sense, in these low permeability zones. So that's the point, is that at this stage, the transmissive zones have cleaned up, at least in a relative sense, compared to what they had been before. And then you've got this back diffusion controlling the system. So then you can, again, think about treatment in this context. At this stage, at a late stage, if you're doing pump and treat of your source area, you may only be trying to address one of the 14 compartments. So anyway, again, this is just kind of an introduction to the 14-compartment model. We carry it through further in the integrated characterization document. But we wanted to introduce it here because it really did help us kind of come up with a way to conceptualize these sites. So the last thing to mention is just an emphasis that at DNAPL sites, vapor intrusion can be an issue, and it needs to be considered in the conceptual site model. At some sites, especially with a DNAPL that was released and may still be present, vapor intrusion, you know, that risk might actually be the driver for a lot of what you need to do. It's not something in the conceptual site model that should be ignored, and it may require a little more sophisticated approach than just reverse calculating the groundwater cleanup target. So we don't go into a bunch of detail here other than just to say that you have to have an understanding of, first, where the mass is distributed, but then second, what impacts any treatment might have if you put a treatment in one of these areas, how it impacts the other. So if you treat the vadose zone, what benefit does that provide to the aquifer and vice versa? So to wrap up the conceptual site model section, when you get through this at your site, you really need to understand the source and plume relationship. Have you accounted for all the transport processes and the exposure pathways, the present or essentially where the mass is present at the site? And then to the extent that you can establish what stage your site is can be really important, whether it's early, middle, or late stage. And one thing I want to mention about that is it's not necessarily just time that drives that. There could be some sites that are, you know, even at a middle stage decades after a release if the aquifer is such that, you know, groundwater flux is really, really low. You know, conversely, there could be a site where a DNAPL was released fairly recently, but if the groundwater conditions are such that there's just a lot of groundwater flux through the area, then the DNAPL could be completely gone and you may be at a middle stage already. So just to summarize, we say if we don't understand the problem, we probably can't solve it. And as I hinted, here is the link to the new DNAPL characterization document. It's an online, it's a web-based document that has a really great resource for tools selections that it goes into as well. So that wraps up the conceptual site model. Now we will turn it over to Trevor King, coming to us from Pennsylvania, to talk about remedial objectives.
Thank you very much, Ryan. And welcome, everyone. So we are now on slide 29, and we are going to be looking at remedial objectives. And before I get into remedial objectives, I just want to kind of reflect on something that most of us have probably read, a story most of us have read or experienced, saw plays in the past. And that pertains back to Lewis Carroll's book with Alice in Wonderland. Many of you may recall the conversation between the cat, the Cheshire cat, and Alice, and she was looking for directions, and the bottom line of that conversation has coined a phrase which you're probably familiar with. And the reason I bring this up is because it's very relevant to what we do in our business, and that is, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. You've probably heard that very often. The same applies to remediation. If you don't know what you're doing or what you or where you need to get to, if you don't set clear objectives, in this case remedial objectives, you're going to probably you're more than likely going to have a problem. So what I want to do today is really focus on remedial objectives and spend a couple of minutes on this subject. So I'm going to talk about not only remedial objectives, but the key here is to be able to set clear and concise remedial objectives. And I want to be able to share with you the benefits of these objectives and the value they can bring to your site. It was actually a lot of discussion that took place when this guidance document was being prepared. And the team with over 30 members, over 400 years of collective experience, you know, they really concluded, we concluded that if we are not able in our business to set clear and concise remedial objectives, it's very difficult based on our experience to measure success. And from experience, most of our projects have resulted in costly overrun. So to manage this, I'm going to talk about, I want to accomplish two things this afternoon as this part of the presentation. First is, how are we going to define clear and concise objectives? We got to make sure that we, you know, we get this, you know, pretty much established as part of our program. And then secondly, I'm going to talk about what is the process for making our objectives, and I'm going to use an acronym, SMART. And this acronym spells effort specific, it needs to be measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. Actually, the SMART concept was developed by George Doran, and because of its use and effectiveness and value, it has been adopted by the American Management Association, and it's used now for setting that objective. At the end of the discussion, I'm going to just do a slide presentation, or I'm going to kind of work an example where we can actually show how to set these objectives, and we're going to test these objectives. So with that, let's jump right into it. So what are the types of objectives? There are two types we're going to talk about this afternoon. They are absolute objectives, and they are functional objectives. In our business, we are probably more familiar with circle objectives, and these are commonly referred to as remedial action objectives. Some of you who are doing characterization may hear of a characterization objective. And the bottom line is, these types of objectives have been classified as either interim objectives or final objectives. When we were developing this guidance document, after much discussion, we agreed that, or we elected to use what we are presenting here this afternoon as absolute objectives and functional objectives, because these can be used to help us distinguish between not only ill-defined objectives, but it helps us to be concise and create objectives which are measurable. So if you wanted to put this into context, we can say absolute objectives are based on what we're very familiar with, broad social values. I want to be able to protect human health and the environment, or in some cases, let's say conservation of natural resources. The problem with this type of objective is, you know, it's difficult to say what success really means or looks like. To different people, it look differently. For some people, it might be reaching MCLs. Others, it might be a risk-based value. So you really have to have some consensus at the beginning of the process to figure out where you need to go and develop a path or a program or an action that gets you there. On the other hand, as shown here, there's functional objectives. And these are all the steps or the actions, so to speak, that we need to take to obtain the absolute objective. So functional objectives are used to satisfy the absolute objective. So for example, if we wanted to reduce, let's say, loading to the aquifer by treating containing or reducing the source, these can all be considered as steps used to obtain protection of human health and the environment in the absolute objective above. However, I want to point out the challenge with this type of functional objective is we really can't determine if you're a regulator, for example, or even if you're a consultant or a project manager, you really can't determine when this change is satisfactory enough to present and to use as a line of evidence that it satisfied the absolute objective. So, recognizing this problem, the guidance documents, when we put it together, we went through a whole set of scenarios and we put together a table, it's table 3-1, that I want to just point you to, that has a number of generic absolute and functional objectives that kind of, it's a starting place for you to check your projects and make sure that your objectives are pretty clear. So as I said, functional objectives need to be SMART. So far, we've answered the question, what are remedial objectives? And we have defined the absolute and the functional objectives. In this slide, let's look at the five attributes. There are five attributes of a SMART functional objective. And they are, it needs to be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. So if we were to look at what specific means, for a functional objective to be specific, It really means the objective should be detailed and it got to be well-defined. You know, that's the bottom line. It got to be well-defined. And the question of how we can make this determination, you know, that's the question we have to ask ourselves. So to do so, we can ask ourselves one of many diagnostic questions, and it's going to be, you know, different for each of us. But for example, we can ask ourselves, well, what exactly are we trying to do, or what can we, you know, what we want to achieve by this particular action? If you can answer any of those questions or the questions that you pose, then we can agree, and others will agree that it's specific. Measurable means whatever we decide on. In other words, the parameters, they should be specified, and they should be quantifiable. For example, we can say a target concentration to eliminate, let's say, vapor intrusion in a building needs to be X micrograms per kilogram. This is both measurable and specific, showing that absolutes sometimes can overlap. Next, attainable, what that means? You know, it means that the objective needs to be realistic within the proposed time frame and the availability of resources. And then relevant, you know, does it have value? Does it represent realistic expectations? One of, let me say, a diagnostic question that, you know, you can ask yourself is, you know, does this outcome of the objective directly support, let's say, the achievement of the absolute objective? If it does, you know, you've got a green light. If it doesn't, you need to revisit it and come up with one that is relevant. And then time-bound. This means that the objective needs to be clearly defined. Not only clearly defined, but it got to be short enough to ensure accountability. In the past, many of us have been in situations where we develop a remedial action that says the site is going to be cleaned up in 30 years or, you know, whatever number of years. And we know for a fact that, you know, most of us are not on those projects when we did them. So what we're proposing is that whatever is proposed for a remedial action or as part of a remedial objective, there needs to be some accountability by us professionals. To help us, you know, kind of figure out how to do this, we actually developed a text box. It's text box 3.3 in the guidance document that goes through a number of you know, these criteria that helps you to set what we're describing as the SMART objective. So if I can leave you with just one thought on this slide, it's functional objectives, they must be made SMART. They're not SMART by default. So I just want to touch base on one of those you know, attributes. And this is the time attribute. Of the five SMART attributes, this was actually the most challenging for us to agree upon. It was actually, after much deliberation, the team actually agreed that the time frame attribute needed to accommodate at least four criteria. And in addition to that, we agreed on what we are considering to be a minimum time period. So the four criteria are shown here that we agreed on is that, you know, the time frame needs to have a criteria of accountability. This means that the stakeholders who set these objectives should remain responsible for their decision. Next, there is, you know, because of groundwater and other issues, you got to recognize there's natural variation either between the contaminants of concern or the, you know, the aquifer conditions in terms of the geochemistry. And these are constantly changing. So you need to keep that in mind when you're developing your objectives and plan and to accommodate these changes. In addition to that, the time frame objective, you know, one of the criteria is you've got to have reliable predictions. Ryan mentioned about you know, about models and some of the predictions. I think it's fair to say we recognize it's difficult to, you know, reliably predict too far into the future, even with these models, but it's a place to start, and so you use that wisely or speak with someone who's familiar on how to use these types of models. And then the fourth criteria I want to mention is really how it pertains to the technological development, that is, the scientific understanding and the technical ability of you know, what we're doing and the technologies. Technology and science has developed at a rapid pace over the last decade, so it makes sense that whatever we come up with in terms of a time frame as part of a SMART attribute needs to be flexible and it needs to be adaptable. You've got to have that you know, in the mix. I mentioned the team actually decided to propose a time frame period, and the team came up with about 20 years or less as a criteria for SMART functional objectives, because this gives us, this encourages responsibility by those who are, in the field of developing remedial action. The team also recognized that, at some DNAPL sites, particularly DNAPL sites, 20 years may not be, sufficient enough. In those cases, we strongly suggest that you develop interim, functional objectives. So with that, having established the SMART objectives and the criteria, several criteria, let's just quickly look at an example site and see how we can set and then test this, this principle. So we've looked at remedial objectives and how to set and make them SMART. So we're going to, in this example, we're going to look at, function objectives and try to figure out if it's a SMART function objective or if it's just a function objective. So here I have a cross-section of a site. This site is actually one that our members, a team member, worked on. And by way of a quick description, we can see here that the geology consists of a clay silt in the unsaturated and saturated zone. And then there's a more transmissive silty sand between around 12 and 18 feet, and that's followed by a clay, about 10 feet of clay silt that's sort of more like an aquifer. The yellow, the depth of water was about seven feet below grade, and here we can see in yellow is where there was a source discharge of PCE over a couple of years, and that migrated vertically through the unsaturated zone to the saturated zone, got into the transmitted zone, and then flowed from south. From north to south, and it's represented by the blue. And it's actually eventually left the site. Some of it was leaving the site. So a developer purchased this property, and this dry cleaner site he wanted to convert into a mall. So he hired one of our colleagues and their company, and the criteria was they needed to remediate this site within a certain time period that would allow redevelopment of the mall within 12 months. So that's something I want you to pay attention to. There was a 12-month stipulation in terms of a time frame for this site. Also, there was a concern that there was potential vapor intrusion for future buildings that may be erected on the site or even off-site. So that was something they had to consider. And this developer didn't want any restrictions. He wanted free and clear. So there was a challenge for the consultant. They did some work, and they were able to establish that based on the sampling program, that the actual work that was done, they figured out that the average soil concentrations were about 4,000 micrograms per kilogram in the soil, and the groundwater was about 180 micrograms per liter in the groundwater. The risk assessment that was done actually identified four potential risks, and they were vapor intrusion to future buildings on site and off site. There was PCE leaching into the groundwater. There was potential for contact in landscape areas in the future mall area, as well as the degradation products. There were degradation products which were migrating off site. So coming out of that, the risk assessment also was able to support some cleanup criteria, and it confirmed that they needed to achieve a soil concentration of 40 micrograms per kilogram for PCE, and that would take care of the indoor air, ambient air, and dermal exposure. And for groundwater, they needed to clean that up to at least 8 micrograms per liter in order to achieve the objective of getting a sign-off from the regulators. MCLs for PCE were about 5 micrograms per liter. So that's the scenario that we have. So in terms of developing a functional objective, first we need to start at an absolute objective, because you got to know where we're going. So a general absolute objective could be protection of human health and the environment, redeveloping the mall area. Seems to make sense. We're very familiar with the first one in every one of our feasibility studies, or rather documents. To support that absolute objective, they came up with a number of functional objectives. And I say here genetic functional objectives. And those included, I'm going to focus on not all of them, just vapor intrusion, because the document itself speaks to all of the different types of risk and potential objectives that needed to be met. But for this illustration, vapor intrusion is the one I'm going to focus on, and particularly from the soil pathway. So they wanted to manage the vapor intrusion, and then they wanted to reduce concentrations of the volatile organic in the VEDA zone to allow no further action for unrestricted use with no engineer or administrative control. So if you look at these functional objectives, on the surface, they may seem reasonable, any of these are achievable. But the question is, how do you measure success? And that's why we would conclude that this is a generic function objective, because if you were to try to test it using the SMART attributes, you'll soon realize that they meet none of those SMART attributes. So I would say, if you wanted to take this same function objective and let's say SMARTify it, and we are now on slide 35, we can say, just looking at the second function objective, just by adding a few metrics, it changes the whole objective. So we can say we want to reduce the concentrations of volatile organics in the VEDA zone, in this case, to less than 40 micrograms per kilogram. That was the number the risk assessment came up with and was approved by the regulator. So we say 40 micrograms per kilogram, and we give ourselves the time frame. In this case, we say 6 months, and that would allow no further action. So by simply just adding a couple of metrics or numbers, we've changed the whole context of this functional objective into one that we are proposing meets the SMART objective. So easier said than done. So the best way to confirm is for us to test it. So if I was to say, well, in terms of specific, how do we confirm whether this function objective meets the specific criteria? So we knew we started at 4,000 micrograms per kilogram, and we needed to get to 40 micrograms per kilogram. So I think we can all agree that that is very specific in terms of where we were and where we needed to go. That's actually represented about a 99% reduction. So any of those could have been used as the metric, 40 or 99% reduction. Is it measurable? And the answer, again, is yes, it is, because, we can do whatever we're doing, and, we can then go back and collect soil samples as we typically do. And if we've met, whether it's an average or at all points of 40 micrograms per kilogram, then we can say that we've met that objective. If not, we just got to continue doing whatever remedial action. In terms of achievable, so there are many technologies that could be brought to bear on this scenario. For example, if we were to use excavation, I think we would probably agree that excavation as a technology is most likely to achieve not only getting it to a no further action and eliminating all concentrations below 40 micrograms per kilogram, but we could also do that probably quite easily within 6 months. There are other technologies such as SV or ISCO or thermal that could also treat this chlorinated compound successfully. The big question with those technologies was, can it achieve it in 6 months? And that's where there lies the problem. So in terms of achievable, you got to ask yourself that question and select a remedy that meets that particular criteria. Is it relevant? The answer is yes. If we were able to clean up the site within the 6 months and redevelop them all within 12 months, that satisfies the client's objective. And is it time-bound? The answer there is obviously yes. It is time-bound. So I think, was that my last slide? Let me see here. Let me just go back. So in conclusion, what I want to say is that we can agree that remedial objectives for DNAPL sites, they need to be consist of not only absolute objectives, but they need to be SMART functional objectives. This afternoon, we talked about absolute and functional objectives. We talked about how to develop and test them to make them SMART or to SMARTify them. We looked at one example for a real site by one of our team members. And I just want to, you know, kind of point out for future reference to you, Chapter 3 of the guidance document provides a lot of detail about remedial objectives for DNAPL sites, and it discusses the value of establishing them for our sites. So now that we've established what our SMART, absolute and SMART objective, it's time as part of the process, again, conceptual site model, remedial objectives. Now we're going to talk about technologies. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Bryant, who is actually an expert with technologies, and he's going to speak to us you know, after Juliana introduces him. So with that, I turn it back to you, Juliana.
Thanks, Trevor. We are going to take a break now for questions. So anyone is welcome to use that Q&A box in the lower right to send in questions. And in fact, you can do that at any time throughout the second half of today's training class. For our phone line participants, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to unmute and ask questions out loud. I also remind you at this point, if you do leave before we wrap up, we do want your feedback. So looking at those related links, the fourth item down takes you to the feedback form. You select the name of feedback, and then you look down a bit. There's a button that says Browse To. That's how you're going to open these related links. We do appreciate you giving us feedback, and many of the same trainers on today's class are working on a new training course. So your feedback is something that we can use immediately. We really do appreciate you giving us feedback to help us improve our training courses. You can also create a certificate of participation through the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended, and then the system will generate a certificate of participation for you for today's training class. Do you have any questions to start from the phone line audience? We had a question that came in online, and I know, Ryan, you answered it online, but I do want to share it so the whole group can hear the answer. How important is the density of the DNAPL type constituents for transport of dissolved phase in groundwater? Or is advection, dispersion, transport more important? Is also a dissolved plume expected to sink?
This is Tams, and I can take a stab at that. This is Tams, and I can actually take a stab at that. So when we talk about fate and transport characteristics of the DNAPL itself, the density is actually really important, along with other characteristics of the DNAPL like viscosity and solubility. All of those characteristics play into how that DNAPL is going to distribute itself in the subsurface environment, you know, and in particular the heterogeneous environment. So density becomes really important as the primary driving force that determines, or you know, one of the things that determines how far into the subsurface that DNAPL is going to migrate based on the amount that's released. So because it's dense, i.e. meaning it's denser than water, what that means is that that DNAPL can infiltrate the water table and migrate vertically. So as a DNAPL, the transport of the DNAPL itself is density driven. It is largely at that point not being controlled by advection. It's being controlled by density, and it's being controlled by the aquifer stratigraphic layers or geologic layers and the heterogeneity of those layers. And so what happens is that DNAPL migrates vertically, and it accumulates in areas where a lot of times there's a permeability difference, so where you might have an interface with a permeable sand, say, and that DNAPL is migrating vertically through the sand, and then it hits, say, a silt layer or a clay layer, and then it can't overcome what's called the capillary pressure, and so it tends to accumulate on those interfaces. And then it might have enough driving force if there's enough DNAPL to actually spread laterally. So density and stratigraphy or geology are the predominant things that impact the transport of the DNAPL itself. Once that DNAPL dissolves into groundwater and creates a dissolved phase plume, then that dissolved plume is largely driven by also heterogeneity and by advection, which is related because, of course, In your more permeable intervals, that's where the majority of that advective groundwater flow is occurring, is in your highly permeable sand or gravel units. And so at that point, then your plume and the evolution of the plume is largely driven by advection. And you can get what's known as diving plumes, meaning that plume can not only have a horizontal component, but also have a vertical transport component. And that's dictated by, again, stratigraphy. If you have geologic permeable layers that are oriented, or say a fractured rock system with those fractures oriented downward, you can get groundwater flow that way. You can also get, or if you have significant vertical gradients, just driven by, you know, a lot of our sites in the Pacific Northwest have a lot of infiltration, you know, where you've got a lot of driving force creates significant vertical gradients, or where you have a really permeable, say in a glacial till, really permeable gravel or sandy unit, you've got a lot of groundwater flow occurring. If you have a lower permeability unit on top of that, because you've got that high flow zone, it tends to also create significant vertical gradients. And then you can get that sort of diving plume, if you will. And so what tends to determine how deep a plume is going to go is, one, how deep the DNAPL made it to begin with. And the extent of that DNAPL migration determines how deep that plume goes. And then once those contaminants are dissolved, then that plume migration in the plume is driven by, again, both stratigraphy and by the groundwater gradient.
Thank you, Tamsin. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. Anyone is welcome to send in questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right throughout the second half of today's training class. We'll go ahead and move on, and we do hope to have time at the end of the class to answer more questions. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Dan Bryant at GeoCleanse International. Dan?
Thank you, Juliana. So earlier in this session, Ryan introduced conceptual site models, and Trevor has discussed developing remedial objectives for your sites. What I will do now is discuss treatment technologies which you can develop and apply based on your conceptual site models in order to achieve those objectives. Now, a couple underlying themes within Chapter 4 of our document with the treatment technologies is how to avoid the trap of relying on a single remedial technology, how to consider the site characteristics and site objectives when deciding upon your technology to apply, and particularly how to apply multiple technologies and integrate them in order to achieve your objectives for your site. So moving on to slide 38, there are four general parts of Section 4, remedial technologies and assessing their performance in Section 4.1, coupling technologies, how to transition between technologies, and we'll wrap up with a brief example from Section 4.4 of the document. So moving now to slide 39, we have summarized in Chapter 4 a number of treatment technologies that are applicable to DNAPL sites. We've tried to provide a very good summary of the key technologies and their performance. What you won't see in the document is a discussion of their sweet spots or sort of a set of conditions that are very conducive to their application. And there are a number of reasons for this, but mainly because there are a number of very specific technology guides are available already for these technologies, many of which we've already we've summarized in the document, but also because there are a wide range of ways to apply these technologies, and there's no real universal consensus among our team about what the best approach is conditions are to apply these technologies. And then another additional theme is how to fit technologies into the 14-compartment model to provide you with a very general sort of tool to evaluate your technologies with respect to their ability to achieve your remedial objectives, and how you can you need to develop estimates of their remedial effectiveness, their future performance, and we'll do that using orders of magnitude or OOMs. So moving now to slide 40, this is a table 4.1 from the document, and it presents how we divided and broke down the technologies for the discussion, three very general technology categories, physical, chemical and biological technologies and containment type of technologies, and then the example individual technologies within them. A number of these technologies can be fit within more than one of those general technologies. We selected the technology category that we think it's most typically applied to. And then we provide a number of references to the application and performance of those technologies. Moving now to slide 41, I want to illustrate how we can utilize the 14-Kapara model to evaluate technology performance and their ability to achieve the remedial objectives that you've set. So the 14-Kapara model was introduced earlier. And what we'll do is we'll take an additional step and we'll add a couple of additional columns to the model. So basically, for example, you could take in the source box in the low permeability area, you can assign a sort of order of magnitude equivalent for the condition now. So you would look, for example, in that source area in the low permeability for vapor, the before condition. So you would assign, say, for example, at your site, a value of 2. And again, this is a very general order of magnitude sort of equivalent condition. And what you next need to do is assign a value for what you could expect your technology to be able to achieve or the performance of that technology in terms of, an order of magnitude. And then you simply subtract the technology performance from the before condition, and that's shown in the blue boxes, to get what your condition would be after. And again, this is not meant as a sort of a quantitative model, but really as a sort of a general guide to help you evaluate your different technologies and get an assessment of what you may be dealing with after application of that technology, which can then be important for moving on or transitioning to the next technology after that. So moving on to slide 42. I talked about orders of magnitude, and why are they relevant for us? Well, orders of magnitude are, of course, powers of 10, and that is a theme that seems to apply a lot in our industry. For example, hydraulic connectivity, you basically think about, for example, in orders of magnitude, is it 10 to the minus 3 centimeters per second or 10 to the minus 5 centimeters per second, rather than whether it's 2.3 times 10 to the negative 5 versus 3.1 times 10 to the negative 5, for example. You think about VOC concentration typically in orders of magnitude. You're concerned is it tens of parts per billion or hundreds or thousands of parts per billion. You use a similar thing with remediation performance. For example, a 90% reduction in whatever metric you're using, whether it's concentration or mass flux. So a 90% reduction would be one order of magnitude reduction. 99.9% reduction is three orders of magnitude and so on. And we provide an equation in the document to calculate those ohms for whatever percentage reduction. So as an example, if your concentration before remediation is 50,000 micrograms per liter, after concentration it's 5, that would be 4 orders of magnitude or 4 ohms. So where do you get those ohms? Well, there's a number of different options that we summarize in the document. Number one, your experience, your knowledge. You're familiar with your site. You're familiar with your site conditions. Chances are good you've got some experience with a range of technologies under similar site characteristics. And that kind of knowledge is going to be very valuable to you to develop what level of OOM you might expect for the performance of technology. Option two, we'll talk more about this in just a moment, data from scientific literature. Multiple site studies will be an example. We'll talk about those in a moment. There's also online, we provide a link here from the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, or ESTCP. They have a DNAPL test system, basically, which includes a number of case studies that provides performance data. And option number three, also a very good option, consult technology specialists or technology vendors for their experience and their expectations for how a technology can perform. So moving now to slide 44, let's talk for a moment about those multiple site performance studies. There are a number of examples of these in the literature, and here at the bottom we show some of these. A couple of strong points about these studies, they're developed typically by independent researchers with a very specific type of methodology to evaluate their sites. They typically represent the spectrum of sites, not only those that are really conducive to a technology, but also those that perhaps aren't so conducive. You know, for example, a clay site, a sand site, bedrock, gravel, whatever. They're based on real data, not anecdotal. And as I mentioned, here are a number of examples from the peer-reviewed literature. So moving to slide 45, this is one example, results from 59 sites published by McGuire et al. 2006. Again, you'll find the full reference in our document. And this is one of the typical types of graphs illustrating the performance data. And this compares three different technologies, bioremediation, chemical oxidation, and thermal remediation at a number of different sites. And this might be typical of what you'll see in these papers. So the blue box for each technology represents the 25th and 75th percentiles. The red box in the middle shows the median percent reduction in, for example, source zone concentration in this case. And that red line across the top would be a 90% reduction, or one oom. And you can see, for example, that all these technologies, when you look at their overall performance, it's typically pretty similar. And their median reductions are in the same range, pretty close to that one oom line. But you can see large differences in the maximum and minimum performance bars. You know, for example, chemical oxidation covers the full range from 0 to 100. And that can reflect challenges in different sites, challenges in the technology, challenges in design and implementation, a number of different factors, regardless of which technology you choose. Moving now to slide 46, there are also some cautions to be aware of when you're evaluating these multi-site performance studies. They're not site-specific. Not every technology can be applied at every site. And we know that from our own experience based on the range of conditions. Some lump pilot scale and full scale projects together, and obviously the objectives in terms of performance and contaminant mass destruction are going to be very different for those types of projects. They may not account for intentional shutdowns. For example, if your remedial objective is 90% removal, you achieve that objective, you shut down. That can affect the outcome in terms of how it compares with percent removal of a source zone, if that's what you're using for your evaluation. There's also no accounting for expertise and design experience in application of these technologies. And bottom line, a lot of these technologies have been around for a long time. And what the success was for, say, a chemical oxidation technology in 1995 or a bioremediation technology in that same time period compared to an application of that same technology today, chances are good it's much improved because our knowledge has progressed much farther. So some cautions for applications of those technologies. Now moving are those types of multi-site studies. Now moving to slide 47. I'll talk now about some of those individual technologies. And again, the document goes into much more detail. But I'll start with the removal types of technologies. For example, excavation obviously can achieve 100% of your remedial objectives if you've adequately defined your site and you have access to your site. Thermal remediation we included under removal technologies. And one multi-site performance study found that you achieved typically less than one oom at 9 of the 13 sites that were evaluated, greater than 2 ooms of contaminant mass reduction at 4 of those 13 sites. Moving now to slide 48, some examples for chemical and biological types of technologies. In-situ chemical oxidation tends to have a median, based on multi-site study, a median reduction of about 0.3 ooms for chlorinated VOCs like DNAPLs. Rebound may be more prevalent for ISCO compared to certain other technologies. In-situ chemical reduction, one example being the ZVI clay process. A limited number of case studies, but those that are available show a median reduction of about 1.7 ooms. Moving now to slide 49, continuing chemical and biological technologies, enhanced bioremediation differs here depending on if you're evaluating just the parent compound, for example, just PCE at a dry cleaner site, compared to the total VOC concentrations, which would incorporate the daughter products. For example, the TCE, cis dichloroethene vinylchloride that will result from degradation of that parent tetrachloroethene. So if you're looking just at the parent, you may see a greater than one order of magnitude reduction. Whereas if you're comparing the total VOC concentration, median values is on the order of about 0.4. And similarly for monitored natural attenuation. Now, a very interesting observation is that monitored natural attenuation is often the sole remedy. In fact, that some 30% of the 445 chlorinated sites that were considered by McGuire et al. In 2004, MNA was the sole remedy applied at those sites. Moving now to slide 50, talk a few minutes about containment technologies. These would include pump and treat. Now, pump and treat can be applied in a number of different ways. It can be considered a direct source area remedy, for example, but I think it's most commonly applied really as a containment technology to prevent a plume from migrating further down gradient. And again, it can be 100% effective in terms of a containment technology if it's been properly designed and constructed, and you're able to evaluate that directly, either from a modeling approach, for example, capture zones, as well as from actual data, your groundwater concentrations. Permeable reactive walls, for example, zero valent iron walls. Again, not as many sites to evaluate, but a median reduction of about 0.8 ohms from six that have been evaluated. Low permeability barriers, for example, slurry walls. We found one multi-site study that found that about 83% of sites met design objectives. Similarly, solidification and stabilization processes can be essentially 100% effective if they're properly designed and applied. Moving now to slide 51, let's talk a little bit about coupling of technologies. And I think this is a very important shift in our industry. Initially, the paradigm would be to utilize one technology at an entire site from cradle to grave. And I think that's now recognized to really not be a very effective approach. And now virtually always some type of technology coupling is incorporated into the remedial design. And there are three really general types. Temporal coupling, for example, apply technology one, followed later by technology two in the same area. There can be spatial coupling, for example, a source remedy coupled with a plume remedy. And there can be simultaneous coupling, which is sort of the same combination of those two types of approaches. Now, with the our experience as a team, we found that there were three very common approaches for coupling. And one was to use a very intensive technology followed by a passive technology. For example, chemical oxidation followed by bioremediation would be a great example of that, or thermal remediation followed by bioremediation. It was also very common to apply different technologies for source areas versus plume areas, and that goes to the strengths of different types of technologies for different types of conditions. And then also a very common theme is any technology followed by modern natural attenuation. I think that speaks to the challenges to fully remediate a site from cradle to grave with any site type of individual technology. You just can't get every molecule and with any single one type of technology. So you're going to end up combining technologies almost always. Now, another very important, very key observation is that in the past, certain opposing combinations were thought to be basically permanent. You couldn't apply a technology after another technology if those technologies were sort of very contradictory or opposing chemical conditions. And I think the classic example of this is first to apply ISCO and then bioremediation. It was initially thought that you could never apply bioremediation in a site that you've utilized ISCO at because the ISCO would kill all the microbes. Well, that's been clearly and resoundingly shown to not be correct. So bottom line, though, is that you just have to factor that into your design. Moving now to slide 52, rationale for coupling technologies. You have to think about the contaminant mass, the fluxes, concentrations. All of these will change over time as your site evolves, and Ryan touched on this a bit in his discussion about the stage of development of your site. Remedial objectives may change in time due to the regulations or how your risks can change at a site. And then finally, multiple contaminants or classes of contaminants may be present, so you may have to couple technologies to be able to address different types of technology. So one technology may not be able to address all the contaminants. You may have a site with both metals, inorganic contaminants of concern, as well as organic contaminants of concern that may need different types of approaches. So that's the rationale about why you would need to couple technologies. And now let's talk about how you might do that. So moving to slide 53, table 4-2, you're not supposed to be able to read this matrix here, but we included a matrix of those nine technologies as table 4-2 in the document. And what we did is we evaluated each combination we assigned one of three different values. For example, generally compatible are coupled technologies that would probably work very well together based on our experience or expectation or what's already well known out there in the literature. Great example would be thermal remediation followed by in situ bioremediation. The second value we would assign is likely incompatible. These are technologies which may not work that well together. I mean, it doesn't mean that you can't apply them, but it would certainly involve some special thought given to the design. And a great example of that would be in situ chemical reduction followed by in situ chemical oxidation. It's very likely to result in destruction of both reagents, again, unless that's all factored into the design. And then finally, potentially compatible but not an anticipated couple. These are combinations of technologies that could theoretically work well together, but not one that we would expect. For example, bioremediation followed by surfactant flushing, because bioremediation can be applied to DNAPL as well as to dissolved phase plumes, but surfactant flushing typically just to DNAPL type conditions. It probably would work, but it's just not likely to be applied in that type of a combination. Now moving to slide 54, transitioning between technologies. These are some examples of some of the triggers that would force you to want to make those transitions. For example, your contaminant concentrations have changed. The phase, you may have destroyed all the DNAPL with one technology. Now you're ready to apply a second technology because the DNAPL is gone and you need something to address the dissolved phase plume. The contaminant lineage, for example, parents versus daughters. Some types of technologies are more effective for the parent compounds and not as effective for the breakdown products, and so you might want to switch up your technology to better address those daughter products at the later stages of your remediation. Site conditions may change or as a result of your technology. And then finally, cost per unit of contaminant destroyed can be a factor. So the cost to apply a technology may be such that it's more effective, more cost-effective to apply technology at higher concentrations than at lower concentrations, and so you want to make a transition based on that, or vice versa. So moving now to slide 55, that transition, and we provided an outline of figure 4-1 in the document to guide that transition. So you implement your remedy, stage one. You evaluate the performance of that technology, something that will be discussed next in this presentation. You evaluate your data, and you ask the question, are we making progress? Yes, you want to continue your remedy. No, can you optimize that remedy and continue it, or should you transition to the next remedy at that point? So let's pull it all together with what is really a pretty simple example, but I think it illustrates a number of the key objectives that we developed in the document. We're going to couple in this example the 14-compartment model with orders of magnitude performance and remedy performance to answer the question, will I reach my objectives? So moving now to slide 57, source area excavation. Okay, so our site, we have identified or we're considering source area excavation as our technology, and we want to evaluate how it's going to perform. So I've just shown the source component or the source portion of that 14-compartment model, and I divided the low permeability and the transmissive zones each into three individual columns. So that before condition, the colored, orange, green, yellow, red conditions represent my before condition, before remedy condition. Again, just as general orders of magnitude considerations. So I assigned those based on some sort of equivalent aqueous concentrations that we showed down here at the bottom, down here. And now I want to evaluate my technology performance. Well, I'm digging it up. I'm completely physically removing the contaminated materials. So basically what I've done is I've assigned to each of the technologies a technology performance of 3 that I'm highlighting here. And then similarly over here, technology of assignment of 3. So that's my order of magnitude estimate of performance of the technology. So I'm just going to subtract the technology performance from the pre-remediation condition. And if it ends up being a negative number, I'll make it 0. And so that's my condition after remediation. So if my objectives required reaching those conditions after the remediation, then this type of an approach would effectively achieve that. So again, this is not meant to be a numeric quantitative model, but instead a very general guide and a way of evaluating different types of technologies in a very straightforward way. So slide 58, a brief summary of what we've talked about. 3 very important concepts. Number 1, remediation is an order of magnitude type of affair. You can utilize those orders of magnitude in the 14 compartment model to get an evaluation of different types of technologies at your site. And you can derive those orders of magnitude from your experience, from multiple site studies, and from discussions with technology experts that have experience with that type of technology at similar types of sites. We also discussed coupling technologies, for example, active followed by passive technologies, source versus plume technologies, and we developed a compatibility matrix as a general guide to help with your selection of how you might couple technologies. And finally, we discussed transitioning between technologies with a flow chart that can help with that. So at this point, what I will do is I will turn it over to Aaron Cohen, coming to us from sunny and warm Florida, who will talk about monitoring the performance of technologies.
Thanks, Dan. I hope you all can hear me.
We can.
We should be on slide 59. And Chapter 5 is here to assist the user in determining what data are needed to monitor your site and assess whether or not your selected remedy or remedies are performing as anticipated and as expected. Specifically, we're going to address the 2 questions shown on the slide, which are, how do you design a monitoring program that assesses your progress towards reaching your functional objectives, and what data should you collect to evaluate remedy performance? You know, our hope is that you don't just collect data and then place it in a file cabinet or a drawer with an out-of-sight, out-of-mind sort of mentality. So we should all be on slide 60, rather. This slide illustrates the 3 different types of monitoring that can be performed at a site. Each type is shown on the slide with a visual representation along with 1 or 2 typical questions that each type of monitoring should answer. If you begin at the top of the slide with performance monitoring assesses the effectiveness of the SMART functional objectives previously established for the site. The figure shows monitoring wells along a transect across a plume. You know, questions you could be asking yourself are, is the remedy reducing the contaminant concentrations as expected? Or maybe at the end of the day, is the remedy working as planned? The goal of performance monitoring is to compare actual data to your SMART functional objectives and provide a yardstick against which you can measure whether or not your remedy is successful. As a regulator, I frequently see sites where there's a remedy, it's been implemented, but the performance monitoring is not adequate to demonstrate whether or not the remedy is performing as expected. You know, and the last thing you want to do is to implement a remedy and not be able to show that you're achieving your objective. The second type of monitoring shown is process monitoring, and that's on the lower left of the slide. Process monitoring is performed to collect data after a treatment system has been turned on or a remedy implemented to show whether or not it's working properly and if you're meeting your remedy-specific SMART functional objectives. It's used to answer questions like, is your system meeting its SMART functional objective of 80% or greater runtime, or is the radius of influence at a vapor extraction well more or less than the expected design? Is your ISCO remedy injecting at the design pressure and are you achieving the design flow rate? You know, all this information can be used to optimize the operation of your remedial system in the field and to improve its overall performance. The third type of monitoring shown is in the lower right-hand corner of the slide, and it's compliance monitoring. This is the most common form of monitoring conducted at a site, and it assesses the relationship of contaminant concentrations to regulatory limits. You know, it answers the question whether or not we're meeting those regulatory limits. It also serves to document the aerial extent of contamination and to explore the status of exposure. Compliance monitoring locations are often specified by federal, state, or local regulations and through a dialogue with your stakeholders. So now that we've covered those, let's move on to slide 61. The type of media you are monitoring should be specific to your functional objectives. If not, then you should ask yourself, why are you collecting this data, and refer back to your functional objectives to ensure that they meet the specific portion of the SMART criteria. Media types that are usually monitored are DNAPL, aquifer matrix solids, or if you prefer to call them aquifer sediment or soil, soil gas, groundwater, and surface water. DNAPL is probably the most difficult to measure. Oftentimes, it's not seen at a site. Very high groundwater concentrations may be indicative of its presence, but actually getting in there and measuring it can be quite difficult. So something to keep in mind is, has actual free-phase DNAPL been found at a site, or is the stakeholder team simply relying on a different type of media to indicate the presence of DNAPL? Next are aquifer matrix solids. These can help establish baseline contaminant concentration levels. They can also be used during and after remedial action is completed to evaluate progress, especially if you're addressing a contaminated zone that may be creating back diffusion, as mentioned earlier. If you have subsurface zones of more or less transmissivity, analyzing aquifer matrix solids may provide information as to whether or not the less transmissive zones were successfully treated and is the remedy functioning as expected. Soil gas can be collected to establish if vapor intrusion pathways exist and if they're an area of concern. It can also be used as a qualitative screening tool to identify DNAPL sources or highly contaminated areas within the unsaturated zone. Groundwater is the ubiquitous measure, the ubiquitous media that's measured. Most regulations are based upon this media. Mass flux and mass discharge are measured in this media, and ultimately we're all probably most comfortable in discussing how contaminated a site is when we're talking about groundwater concentration. Surface water is also listed on the slide because depending upon your site conditions, groundwater may be discharging to a surface water body. The team didn't want to leave this off the list as a possible media requiring monitoring. So let's move on to slide 62. The metrics for monitoring media are listed on this slide. Once media is selected, it's important for the whole team to understand what metrics are going to be reported. They go along with the concentrations that are being measured. Concentration data is dependent upon the media that's being measured, and it's typically reported in micrograms or milligrams per liter, milligrams per kilogram, or PPMV, parts per million by volume for groundwater, soil, or aquifer matrix solids, and soil gas, respectively. Contaminant mass is usually measured in kilograms. Mass flux is usually measured in grams per meter squared per day. If you integrate that measurement across the perpendicular area of the material in which it's flowing through, the measurement becomes mass discharge, and it's measured in grams per day. For more information on mass flux and mass discharge, if you have any specific questions, I'd recommend that you look at the ITRC Mass Flux 1 guidance document. Or attend one of the online mass flux training classes. It'll sort of bring you up to speed on the difference between mass flux and mass discharge, and you might consider using it at your own site. Let's move on to slide 63. So after we talk about what type of data may be relevant to your site and what types of media can be monitored and the metrics in which the data will be reported, it's time to look at that data and evaluate what the performance at your site looks like, relate it back to your functional objectives, and determine how well your remedy is functioning and whether or not your remedy is achieving your objective. As mentioned previously, the CSM is a living document, and as such, it needs to be maintained and improved. A great way to do this is to incorporate all the data you collect while implementing your remedy back into the CSM. You can use your data to improve your understanding of the site, as well as evaluate your remedy performance. Data can also be put to good use when used as a visualization tool, as shown on this slide, to communicate site conditions, to illustrate changes over time, and to improve site understanding for both the project team and the stakeholders. Let's face it, it's generally easier for most people to get an understanding of site conditions if you illustrate them in a picture rather than presenting them with a stack of data tables simply showing concentration data. The big thing that data is used for is evaluation, and this is where statistics can be used. You can use statistics to identify and understand trends, and the point here is to use your data to determine whether or not you are achieving your functional objectives. Questions to consider might be, is your remedy performing as expected? Does your remedy need to be optimized? Should your remedy be reevaluated? The last thing you want to do is to continue the operation of a remedy that's not achieving its objectives. Simply put, you know, you're wasting time, resources, and money. We should be on slide 64. This slide deals specifically with trends. Trending is one of the most common statistical methods. It's a way to quantitatively describe the rate at which change is occurring. So the figure at the right of the slide is from Chapter 5 in the document, and it illustrates a decision framework from which you can begin the data trend interpretation process. If you start at the text box circled in red, the text asks the question whether or not your groundwater source for plume is being actively treated. Depending upon your answer, yes or no, you move either into the blue pathway indicating remediation is occurring or into the orange pathway indicating remediation is not occurring. Then you look at your data and determine if your trend is increasing, stable, decreasing, or if there appears to be no trend at all, depending upon whether or not you are performing active treatment. If you have active treatment, you can refer to Table 5.2 in the document, or if you have no active treatment, you can refer to Table 5.3 that offers possible interpretations and the types of decisions needed based upon the trends that you're seeing. Slide 65 talks about how you can also use your data to help model performance that you're seeing at your site. Modeling can be helpful and informative, as well as a great visual tool to show what's taking place at your site. Modeling can help you answer questions like, is what's taking place at my site what we expected? Is the CSM accurately reflecting what the data is telling you? Does the CSM accurately communicate what you expect it to communicate? There are a lot of different types of models out there. The two most common are probably source zone models, which simulate the impact of remediation or MNA at your source zone, and robust fate and transport models that can be used to evaluate plume stability and attempt to simulate 2 and 3D plume movement. We're not going to go into detail. Just a couple examples of models out there are REMCLOR and natural attenuation software. One thing to remember is that the most current models are based upon the advection dispersion model, and a lot of the new information we're hearing in the industry, as was mentioned earlier in the discussion on geology, indicates that advection diffusion might be a more accurate model. So you need to sort of keep that in mind when you're thinking about a model for your DNAPL site. But we should be on slide 66 now. And here we have an example which brings together modeling data with actual monitoring results. And it's a great way to look and see if your actual on-site data correlates with your modeled or predictive data. Do the two correlate, or is there a wide gulf between them? The figure on the right shows contaminant concentrations versus time on a log scale. And if we start at the lower right-hand corner of the slide with well MW59, we see that the well is located in the source zone, and the figure shows that the monitoring data matches relatively well with what the model predicted based upon what would happen if we performed aggressive source zone treatment and what type of concentration decrease we might expect to see. Next, we move downgrading of the treatment zone to well MW29, where a permeable reactive barrier wall was installed. The figure shows the impact of the remedy, and again, the monitoring data matches up pretty well with the modeling data. Finally, we move downgradient of the PRB to well MW37. And again, the model and the monitoring data both show that the delayed impact of the treatment had at the site. So moving on to slide 67. Now we can take a step back and realize that a lot can happen over the time frame in which your remedy is implemented and operated. As your site transitions from remedy implementation to remedy operation to long-term monitoring, your data needs change. It's important as a stakeholder or as a practitioner to realize this, and to realize that as your site conditions change, so will your monitoring requirements. Your monitoring program should be periodically evaluated and optimized. You should ask yourself some questions like, is the monitoring program still relevant and applicable? Does it need to change? Am I collecting redundant data, or do I have data gaps? Should I change the frequency of my monitoring events? Should they go from, quarterly or monthly to annually or biennially or every 5 years? These are things to keep in mind when you're trying to optimize your monitoring. Once you address the question of monitoring frequency, you should consider the question of what data are being collected. This should be spelled out in your functional objectives, but you also need to ask yourself, do I need to collect and analyze for a whole suite of contaminants and parameters, Or can the sampling and analysis of just one or two key compounds explain the bigger picture at the site? As a regulator, one of the things I hate to see is a non-optimized monitoring program. We frequently see sites here in Florida where they are presented with lots of data, and one of the first things you notice when you're looking at tables is that the same wells have been sampled quarterly for the last few years or longer, and a large portion of them are below detection limit, and they've been below detection limit for quite some time. You know, you aren't doing yourself or your clients any favors by expending the time, the effort, and the money on the collection of data that doesn't improve or update your CSM. The caveat to this, now that I've said that, is that sometimes you may be required to perform long-term monitoring of a well that is BDL to satisfy a regulatory requirement, such as a downgradient point-of-compliance well. As with modeling, there are several free tools to help you evaluate and optimize your monitoring well networks. Two that come to mind and that are shown here are MAROS and GTS. So slide 68 sort of serves to illustrate how your monitoring strategy should bring everything together. This is sort of a crazy kind of, you know, mixed up picture, and it shows the combination of field data, lab data, screening data, maybe some literature data, and it combines all of that with site-specific and knowledge and experience, modeling results, data analysis, tool results, and the current CSM to try and understand what the data is telling us and how we can evaluate it. This all feeds together to create this body of knowledge that allows you to make technically based decisions and a well-reasoned evaluation of the remedy with respect to attaining your functional objectives. So that wraps up Chapter 5 on monitoring, and now I will turn it over to Tamsin to discuss Chapter 6.
Thank you. So Chapter 6 is really the part of the program that deals with how do you evaluate your remedy. And the reality is that especially for chlorinated solvent sites, many of our sites have been around for a long time. You know, these sites were put on things like the NPL list in the 80s and 90s. And so we've been working with them for decades. We've been implementing characterization and remediation, and really things have not always worked as well as we expected. So Chapter 6 is really the point in the process that a lot of us are at when we come into the program. We're looking at how to evaluate our chlorinated solvent sites. And so this is really reevaluating the site. This is understanding, are you meeting objectives? And if you're not, what can you do about it? And how can you evaluate your site, implement a more streamlined, appropriate process, accounting for updates and your site understanding, and what's sort of the feedback loop that you go through to do that? So this is really, how do you evaluate, how do you optimize, and if needed, how do you revise your remedial strategy? And so this is largely focused around some key questions. One of the things we've been talking a lot about is really this concept of these functional objectives, and they really are these micro steps, these interim objectives, your performance objectives, your technology objectives that collectively tell you whether or not you're reaching your remedial action objectives. And so how can we assess that? You take all the things that Aaron just talked about with our monitoring program and determine, are we making acceptable progress? Is there ways that we can do things more efficiently? And if we're not making acceptable progress, how can we revise our strategy? So the first question is really, are the objectives being met? And the first concept that our team talked about a lot is, and that the document talks about a lot, is really how frequently do you need to monitor and assess progress, and really timing is everything, and the scale of monitoring depends on where you're at in the remedial program. Are you implementing aggressive or active treatments? Your process monitoring for those active treatments is likely going to be on a much tighter timeline than, say, a long-term monitoring program where you're evaluating an M&A remedy that is going to be active for decades. So whether or not your timescales are sufficient to allow you to understand if you're making progress, and more importantly, to make decisions appropriately and timely is really important. So is a five-year review frequent enough or not? So this also allows you to make changes and to optimize the system or to troubleshoot the system as needed. So first is that if you are making progress and you determine that your remedy or the parts of your remedy that you're currently implementing are making acceptable levels of progress, we recommend that you evaluate whether or not optimization. And there's a whole slew of guidance documents available on optimization. DOD, EPA, Army Corps of Engineers, you know, all of them have a lot of documents about specific technologies and how to optimize it. And really, it's within our industry something that we understand is important because our industry is dynamic and it's changing, and there's always advances that are occurring, not just with enhancing technologies and technology optimization and the advancements with those technologies, but really even just the way we're managing these programs. Environmental laws are always changing. Our strategies for addressing those are changing. Our ability to set different kinds of remedial objectives are changing. And so it really, this optimization allows you to go back and to look at each of these elements of your remedy, from your performance goals, your functional objectives, to your technologies, and ask yourself the question, can I do it better and more efficient? I mean, not to mention the monitoring program that Aaron was just talking about. There's a lot of tools, even if you're in long-term monitoring, that allow you to perhaps implement that program more effectively and more efficiently. So if you are asking yourself the question, am I making acceptable progress towards meeting the objectives, this in our, we're in our flow chart here, and the answer to that question is no. You're clearly not, you know, you might have stable concentrations, you kind of hit a point of diminishing returns on your technology implementation, you're not seeing a stable plume, then what can you do? How can you reevaluate your remedy? And the first thing that we recommend, because a lot of times what happens is that if something isn't working, we automatically go back to the technology that's being applied. We go to the bio or the thermal or whatever it was that was done. We're still not meeting our objectives, and the consensus is, oh, well, that technology failed. And so we do get into this cycle of implementing, okay, well, let's try the next technology. Oh, that one didn't get us there. Let's try the next technology. So it's this circular loop of just trying one technology after another and kind of taking the whack-a-mole approach, if you will. When in reality, what we find when we go back and look at these sites where the remedies have not really been working as expected, and I would say more often than not, it's really because the conceptual site model is inaccurate or incomplete. And so our team is advocating go back to that conceptual site model first and ask yourself some key questions. Is it complete? Are there things that I'm missing about my site that could be causing these concentrations or these trends that I'm seeing to behave the way that they are? Go back to that basis of understanding. Do I really understand the hydraulics of the site? And our team did, because there's just a whole range of things or ways that the conceptual site model can be inaccurate, is we listed them in the document and we said, make sure that you understand things like the vertical delineation and you understand the stratigraphic layers of your site and you understand whether matrix diffusion or sorption could be significant, that you understand the hydraulics of your system. You know, one of the things that I always see is that very often, you know, people collected, you know, one round of groundwater levels and they've been using, you know, those gradients for every calculation for the last 10 years without accounting for things like seasonal variability. And so really understanding that the sites are dynamic, they're complex, understanding where that source mass is, and where the flow is. These are all very common things as you read down this list of reasons why, you know, our black box could be misinforming our decisions. And so based on that, once you have gone back and you really looked at that conceptual site model and said, okay, well, I think it's of sufficient quality, or we've gone back and done some characterization and filled some key data gaps, then the next thing to really ask yourself, again, we're not going to technologies, we're going to objectives, and really looking at, do I have an appropriate set of these near-term objectives or metrics that are really giving me very defined and measurable, these SMART objectives, you know, steps towards meeting some end goal. And one of the things that our team talked about a lot is that very often the metrics that we're using or how we're implementing those metrics really don't align with the remediation that's being performed. And one very common thing is that, you know, very often you'll be implementing some source treatment and the goal is to achieve concentration reductions at some point down gradient, say in the distal part of your plume. But if the distal part of your plume is 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 years in travel time from the source, then you obviously can't use that point to evaluate the progress of your source treatment. In addition, do you really understand your sources? One of the things or the quotes that I really like is that sources tend to reveal themselves when treated. So you go in and you do some source treatment, expect some concentration reductions, and you don't see it in a certain area. You find other sources. It's something that is very common, especially with these older sites where we didn't necessarily have all the data to tell us where all the sources were. So going back through and really looking at these objectives, making sure that they're clear, making sure they're really linked to the near-term actions that you're implementing, and that they're SMART is the next step in this reevaluation process. So now we get to what everyone wants to talk about, and that is really the technologies and troubleshooting the particular technology. And so this is really looking at, again, Dan talked a lot about what can technologies really achieve, this one order of magnitude reduction with a given technology. And if you have to achieve a 5 or 6 or 7 order of magnitude reduction, you're going to need some interim steps in there as you're implementing technologies and really understanding what those technologies are buying you in terms of reducing risk, reducing mass, and making progress towards those ultimate objectives. So when we're looking at making technology decisions, there's really some key things to decide. Do I keep implementing the current program, continue to implement those technologies? Do I optimize those technologies? Do I expand the treatment zones or retract the treatment zones or modify things? Do I quit operating and transition to something else if the current strategy really isn't buying a lot in terms of making goals? And so what we did is developed a conceptual example that's shown here regarding how this remedy decision making could work. And in this case, this is a conceptual example of a source treatment where the overall goal is to decrease the mass discharge from that source by 99% in 5 years. And the strategy, and this is sort of based on our experience, is that you might implement, say, an aggressive treatment strategy like an in-situ thermal in that source to achieve a very large reduction in mass in a relatively short time frame, say 5 months, followed by an attenuation period where you might achieve, say, another order of magnitude reduction in the next 4.5 or 5 years or so. So that's sort of the way, based on looking at attenuation at the site, evaluating that aquifer attenuation capacity, it's been determined that we think that other order of magnitude reduction can be achieved in that 4.5 years. So we look at our baseline mass discharge measurement. This is the percent. We implement that aggressive treatment, get that order of magnitude, and then get the next one. So that's kind of that's what we think is going to happen. You go out, you implement that technical strategy, you implement this aggressive source treatment technology, and what we see here is that you get mass reduction and it looks pretty good, but pretty soon you start to see that that technology is not performing as expected. And at the end of that first 5 month operational period, you really only achieved a 60% reduction instead of 90%. So the key questions at this point is, should this aggressive treatment continue? And what is the impact towards achieving the overall objective of a 99% reduction in discharge? So this is where sometimes our objectives are not always static, you know, they're fluid. And so always kind of keep the end goal in mind and understand that if we get a 60% reduction instead of a 90% reduction, what that would mean is shown here. We wanted to get to here and we got to here, but based on that attenuation capacity, it would take about another 2 years of attenuation to achieve that ultimate 99% goal. So the question is that okay? Does that fit within the timeline that you're trying to achieve the goal for the site? If the answer is yes, then you should look at potentially shutting down that aggressive treatment, especially if it's very expensive, or it's determined there's some site-specific factors that really are limiting the performance of that technology. Or if the answer is no, then that's where you have to look to either optimize or troubleshoot that aggressive technology or potentially go to a plan B. Is there another interim technology that could be applied and bridge the gap, something perhaps like in situ bio, that would accelerate the attenuation rates, if you will, during this period to try to bring this portion of it back down to the original goal? So these are the kinds of decisions that really have to be made when you're implementing a remediation program and balancing. And again, our team is really advocating, you know, this is a process and it's fluid and it's dynamic, and you really are going to have to go back and reevaluate the basis of your decisions relatively frequently, especially for these complex sites, because they are complex and they are difficult, and we are often making decisions without knowing 100% everything about the site, and we are making those decisions with uncertainty. And so by applying this process, what we're advocating is really looking at these key elements of your program, understanding things like the conceptual site model is a living document, understanding that these objectives that we set, you can have your overarching ones like restore groundwater, but you really need specific ones that are linked to these smart functional attributes so that you can implement specific technologies more effectively. Plan these key transitions between your technologies, understanding that almost all these remedies are going to require multiple components, and putting a strategy together that links all of those components, repeatedly evaluating performance and making adjustments as you need to. It's really this adaptive strategy approach, and reevaluating the strategy periodically and understanding that you might have to go a different direction at some point. You might have to make major changes in the program. These programs are not static. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alex McDonald, and he's going to summarize our training.
Thank you, Tamsin. You guys should all be on slide 82 here. One of the things you, if you look through what we've gone through over the last couple hours, we basically had many different points we wanted to make. First off, Ryan brought to you how to maintain and improve a site's conceptual model. And remember, if you looked over time, that model changes. So you have to constantly look at that as you get new information, update that model, and make sure it stays current with what we know today. And then Trevor came in and gave us setting of objectives, primarily making those objectives smart, and so that when we come to remediation, we have something we can all rely upon saying that, hey, we meet these, we have met the objectives, the remedy is working. So making those objectives smart works out best for everybody. And then Dan came in and gave us a whole bunch of different technologies on how to use them, how to apply them, how to couple them on remediating sites with Dean apples. Then Tamsin came in and eventually she gave us what was the iterative performance evaluation and reevaluating your strategy. In other words, make sure that through your monitoring that your performance of your remedy is working as intended. Is it meeting its objectives along the way? If not, you can reevaluate your strategy, potentially provide a new strategy to work on. It's not something fixed in stone. Once your site conceptual model and your remedy is in place, doesn't mean you don't want to go back and make sure you're looking at those things. And then regulatory issues, we really didn't cover that much in our discussion. I've been looking at this since we put out this document like 5-6 years ago, and I've attempted to apply the strategy. The parts that tend to be controversial tend to be the SMART objectives and potentially using mass flux matrix. And I see over time that my fellow regulators are beginning to accept these types of things but not in many instances. Their organizations above them tend to be a little bit slow on the uptake, should we say, especially in setting SMART objectives. They're not what they're used to, so that immediately since it's something they're not that they're used to, they tend to stand back and say, no, we like the way we're doing it. But I've tried several different times to work on SMART objectives into decision documents that I don't have direct authorship of. In many instances, they say, yes, thank you, but no, thank you. That's going to change here. I have a site that's coming up now that actually I get to write the objectives for. So in that instance, they'll be SMART, and it's going to be an EPA document. So that I'm looking forward to doing that. One other thing we wanted to get through here is, if you go to our next slide, there are several different documents that we've produced over the time. If you look at them, all these sources on DNAPLE, our current topic today is a technical and regulatory guidance for DNAPLE site strategy. We have come up with a new document recently. It's characterization of sites with DNAPLE, and it's got a great tool function table in it. We are currently giving a training on that through the ITRC. And then actually after that, the team is now working on a document that should be coming out in 2017 on characterization of sites with fractured rock, so including DNAPLE. One last thing I want to leave you with is that even though we're talking about DNAPLE in all of our discussion today, if your site does not have DNAPLE, all the processes, all the ideas, all the thoughts, all the concepts can apply, except those that specifically deal with DNAPLE, to a site without DNAPLE. In fact, you can take this integrated DNAPLE site strategy, take out the DNAPLE portion, and call it an integrated site strategy document. And that will help you, on your sites that do not have DNAPLE. With that, I'll turn it over to Juliana for our last question and answer period.
Thank you, Alex. Everyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to send in questions. If you're on the phone line, it's #6 to unmute, and you're welcome to jump in with a question to ask out loud. Before we get to those questions, I do want to point out we have links to additional resources. If you follow this link on the slide, it's going to take you to a page where you can download the presentation for today's training. You can access the document that's the basis of today's training, and we've gathered together several other resources that you may find useful. We also ask you to complete the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. One of the things you can get through the feedback form is a participation certificate. So if you'd like a certificate for attending today's class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to confirm that you participated today. The system will then generate a certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get it is through filling up the feedback form. So please remember to check that box. If you forget, just go back, check the box, and then the system will generate that certificate for you. Do you have any questions from the phone line audience? We had a question that came in online. Working on a creosote site where the plume is not defined, DNAPLE is running along the top of a confined layer of silty clay. We have followed it all the way to the banks of a large creek. The sampling protocol that was suggested is pore water sampling and creek bed sampling. I'm concerned that the creek bed sampling will provide a pathway for the creosote to enter the creek, since right now our surface water samples are clean. What would you suggest? What do the regulators on the team think?
This is Alex. One of the things I'm not clear to me with the question is, at what depth are we going to be collecting these stream bed samples? Obviously, you can't, if you leave the hole open and do not properly, you know, seal it back off after you've collected the samples, then there could be an issue with water contacting that creosote and then dissolving it and bringing it back up. So I think through, if you carefully enough take your sample and then properly abandon the borehole afterwards, just like we do in any situation, that can resolve the issue on potential contact between the DNAPL and the surface water.
Thank you.
Yeah, and in terms of the only other thing I would add is that, you know, creating a pathway, especially if you have a hydraulically isolated creek bed and you have a groundwater plume migrating potentially under that creek. We do have, I have a site where we have a similar situation with the DNAPL actually, and we did do sampling, but what we had to do is ensure that the sampling methodologies and in particular the completion of the boreholes and such where we were doing the sampling, you know, used bentonite and other things to ensure that we resealed those, you know, borings that we used to do the creek bed sampling. So there are options if you don't want to do pore water sampling, you know, by installing some pore water samplers. You can also do soil coring and sampling and evaluate soil concentrations and estimate pore water concentrations based on those results. That's actually what we ended up doing rather than doing the pore water, like the passive samplers. Because of that, we wanted to just pull a core and then seal the hole. So there is some options for doing that to get that kind of data. And the other potentially is really just looking first, and we actually did a whole stream bed sampling program using temperature monitoring just to evaluate first if there was discharge occurring in the stream bed. So first we verify, is there discharge? Are there areas where there's groundwater where it seems, or where there's evidence that groundwater is discharging to the stream? And then we use that to inform the locations and the type of sampling that we did to estimate contaminant concentrations in those sediment beds.
Thank you. If the boreholes were underwater, would what you just said still apply as being the best way to abandon them?
Go ahead, Pam.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, generally we use, you know, very small, discrete types of coring samplers. But we did do it with a driller. And in the for the sediment sampling, we used angled borings to actually get, as well, to get under some of the sediment areas or the target sediment sampling areas, just with a direct push rig. So there is ways to potentially to collect those sediment samples. You know, if you don't want to come in straight vertically, you can also consider angled borings.
Thank you. We are almost out of time, and we do appear to be out of questions for now, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. If you do have a question that you haven't had a chance to ask and would like us to follow up, please email me at training@itrcweb.org. training@itrcweb.org. We'll follow up with trainers on any of these unanswered questions. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really are going to use your feedback as we develop new classes and as we continue to improve this training class. More information about ITRC is on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.